Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome writer and poet Simon Ortiz. A new book is just coming out about him and his work, titled Simon J. Ortiz, A Poetic Legacy of Indigenous Culture, edited by Evelina Zuni Lucero and Susan Berry Brill de Ramirez. And he will be speaking tonight, Wednesday, August 19th, at a special free event as part of Indian Market. It's called Native Tongues Literacy Art Night. It's at 6 o'clock at the St. Francis Auditorium at the Museum of New Mexico, right here on the plaza in Santa Fe. And that will include Simon Ortiz and four other Native writers and will be moderated by Evelina Zuni Lucero. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me a part of your event program. And, of course, this dialogue or conversation that we're having. I'm very happy, you know, for it to be taking place.
Thank you. Me too. I've just been reading your work of poetry. I haven't been able to get my hands on the new book. It's just literally hot off the press. But yeah. You're from Acoma Pueblo. Your mother tongue is Karasan. Is that how you say
Karas,
it?
Karas, yes. That's the language that is indigenous or native to Acoma Pueblo, as well as six other pueblos. Acoma and Laguna are the ones that are closest as neighbors or sister pueblos, so we speak about the same dialect. There's an eastern dialect that other pueblos like Cochiti, Santo Domingo, Santa Ana, San Felipe, and Zia speak the eastern dialect of the Karas language. It's basically the same language.
So indigenous languages, and I don't speak any other than European languages, but as I understand, they have not only different words for things than Western languages, but also a different way of thinking and perceiving. Is this true?
Well, very much so, because culture determines your understanding or comprehension of your world. And so there is, I think, the distinctions made between your cultural experience, your cultural development is quite different from that of, say, Western Europe or Africa or Asia. And so the indigenous people and our cultures, you know, are very distinctly members within that cultural world.
So having grown up, as you did, with both languages, how does that affect your writing?
Well, obviously, the experience that a person has in any everyday world, you know, everyday moment, of course, is varied, you know. And when I was a child, a boy, growing up in the Acoma community of McCarty's, where I was raised in the small village on the reservation, west of Albuquerque, I became aware of my world, that is the cultural world of the Acomejano or Acoma people, in the language of the Karas, you know, of Acoma. And so I saw things according to the world, according to that world. And then later on, when I went to school at 6 years of age and began to learn English, I knew a little bit of English before I went to school, but when I went to school, of course, the language of instruction was English, a language that was totally different from the Acoma indigenous language. And so I began to be a part of that world. In other words, you know, as a child, seeing in another world, but being able to live within that world, because languages in some sense are similar, you know. I mean, as human beings, I mean, we, even though we may have different cultural languages, we are still living within the same world, you know, that is in New Mexico, and the school was in Acoma, on Acoma land, homeland in our community. And even though the language in school was English, it was still the same context, in the physical context, that is, the landscape of Acoma. And so certain expressions in the Acoma language may differ from how we describe and how we feel, but still, as human beings, you know, we are still able to express, you know, what it means to be hot and or cold or sad or happy in the Acoma language, as well as the new language that I began to learn, which was English. And my writing, of course, became, I didn't really immediately start to be a writer when I went to school at 6 years old, not until I was a teenager, you know. But by that time, I was already aware of what stories and storytelling, according to the way I learned the Acoma language. And so writing, of course, comes from what you experience. And my experience was within the Acoma cultural world, but it was also part of the non-Acoma cultural world, because I began to experience that when I began to start learning of that world in school and reading and writing like all grade school children do.
As a young person, you went to Indian boarding schools, and those basically never allowed children to speak their own languages. You also worked at a uranium plant. You studied chemistry. You did time in the military. What were the things in all of those different times that set your direction as a writer?
Later on, of course, after completing the sixth grade at McCarty's Day School, which is the name of the school at home, you know, run by the and funded by the federal government, the Bureau, through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. After I finished the sixth grade, then a decision was made that I would go to boarding school, Indian boarding school, which was St. Catherine's in Santa Fe, which is a parochial or Catholic Indian boarding school. And then there, you know, the only language that was really encouraged or urged and allowed was the English language. We spoke our native languages, but it was not the language of instruction or in prayer, you know, like because since it was a Catholic boarding school, then we were required to go participate in the services, you know, the religious services of the nuns that were in charge of the school. And so we had to only use really English officially. If those of us who knew our languages and spoke our own languages had friends from our same community, we spoke our own languages. But because there were numbers of other tribal languages there, like the northern pueblos, like the Tewa and Tewa people, mm-hmm. from Taos or from San Juan Pueblo or Tezuque, we could not understand them because there are five different pueblo languages, and Acoma is, or the Carriz language is just only one of them. I mean, there were also Navajo students there and maybe Apache students, and so we couldn't speak in their languages, but we could speak, all of us could speak some kind of English, you know, whether it was perfect or broken English, we spoke it. And so in that respect, we were encouraged or urged and allowed only really to officially use English. And then later on, yes, of course, my experience away from school, once I finished high school at Grants High School, I went to college, and then I went into the U.S. military for 3 years. And I think that all of this experience that I had became part of my own evolution or development as a writer. That's true, you know, because I mean, I'm a writer that, like most writers, writes from his experience. And I think that has always been my most reliable resource, the experience that I've gone through. And I think that because I find the integrity and the value of my own native or indigenous cultural community and world and land to be the most essential and most solid, then obviously I speak from that experience, you know, quite a lot, or probably the most primarily.
We're talking to Simon Ortiz, who will be tonight at 6 o'clock at the St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art in an event for Indian Market called Native Tongues Literacy Art Night.
Yes, I certainly will be there.
We're looking forward to it. So some of the themes in your work are, for example, the fact of colonization of Native people in their own land, and then the very strange comments and attitudes of non-Indian people toward Native people. One of them that stood out to me when I was reading in your collection of poems called Out There Somewhere was, yeah. I'm assuming this is a true story, tell me if it's not, but there was a poem in which a very earnest, freckled white lady said after a poetry reading, "Indians are hard to save."
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of these incidents end up in your poems. I mean, how do you hold these kinds of comments?
Well, colonialism and the history of the United States, of course, is part of what colonization is. The history of the United States, of course, dates from when people began to migrate from the east to the west, you know, from the east coast to the west coast, beginning, after the U.S., United States, or the colonies, declared their independence from British rule, you know, and gained their independence in 1776, some movement had begun previous to that, but after that, you know, they began crossing the Appalachian Mountains, which are nearby in the western parts of, say, Maryland or Virginia, and then on across the continent, you know. And, of course, the continents were not empty. They were populated by indigenous peoples, you know, peoples in the woodlands, such as around the Great Lakes, people in the south, not just the Cherokees and Choctaws, and then into the Great Plains, you know, the Dakotas, you know, and Oklahoma, and then into New Mexico, lands of the Pueblos. I mean, every place that it was possible to move from east to west, you know, the settlers, colonial settlers, you know, encountered indigenous peoples. I mean, it was very much an occupied or lived in area, you know, in every step of the way. There was no real spot where there were not Native or indigenous peoples. Well, of course, you know, history shows that the United States, in its movement from east to west, did make treaties of some sort, but treaties made resulted in treaties being broken. And the treaties were agreements, you know, with the indigenous population. And so we find the history of the United States is a history of colonialism or colonization. Settlement, you know, obviously is a much kinder word, but in some cases it wasn't, the colonization or settlement was not very kind, because even if there were agreements like treaties officially made, and agreed upon by both the indigenous people or communities and the non-indigenous, the settlers or colonizers from the east, were not very kind. In other words, you know, they was quite traumatic. And so to refer to these, obviously, you know, you refer to them as fact, as historical experience, and Native or indigenous peoples, you know, because they were the original inhabitants, you know, always felt that they were the ones to have to change or have to move or have to succumb or have to experience loss, you know. And so there were, of course, ways in which people did benefit from some change, you know, and I think that one of those is some idea of how we are living today, because we use the Americana Tseni, you know, the American language, which is English, and we are able to express ourselves, assert ourselves according to what we feel is right and just for us. And I think that the arts is one way in which we express ourselves. And certainly Native American people who are the indigenous peoples of this Americas express ourselves according to how we feel that we justifiably maintain our cultures, maintain our languages, you know, the best we can in the face of, quite a lot of tremendous pressure to forget or to forego and use less of our culture in order to be able to move, comfortably and within ways that are hopefully not just accommodating or compromising, but are beneficial to us, you know. And oftentimes we find it very, Native people, indigenous people, find it very difficult to change if they're going to be required to lose their languages or to not speak or not act the way that they naturally and organically and truthfully want to move or choose.
What do you think it takes for a culture to survive colonization or colonialism, and what is the role of literature in that survival?
Well, one of the things I think that has taken place is a recognition of that loss. For example, land, of course, is very fundamental. Land is where we make our living. Land is where we live. Land is where we, like for Pueblo people, indigenous Pueblo people, we're traditional farmers, you know. And so if they're able to hold on to their lands along the river bottoms or, where there's places in which agriculture can be practiced and livings be made from, if that's recognized and acknowledged by whatever the colonizers, you know, the settlers, that would be great. I mean, I'm talking about in the present day, you know, like Pueblos have lands along the Rio Grande, limited or small lands, you know, amounts of land. And yet, you know, of course, the process of civilization, modern civilization, has taken a lot of the land and a lot of the water, and the people are not able to make an adequate living. And so we end up working like other citizens, you know, in the cities, or working for school systems, or working at whatever jobs there are. Well, I think it takes recognizing of sovereignty. You know, sovereignty means the indigenous and cultural way of life and governing. You know, like each of the pueblos have their own form of government led by the governor, which in some cases are really a form of governance that was established by Hispanic civilization, when the Spanish, who preceded the Americans in the Southwest. And I think that it's important that the recognition of the sovereign authority and the sovereign existence of the native populations be recognized. You know, that means that reconciliation has to involve an expression of the truth. In other words, there is really the need for reconciliation, but really the truth needs to be expressed along for reconciliation to be real, or to be part of the dialogue and part of the way that we finally come to a resolution. And literature obviously has a place in this, because literature is knowledge. Literature is not just books that it's not just writing or words on the in a pretty picture. Literature is knowledge that is very fundamental, and I think that the native or indigenous writing is indigenous expression of what would you say would be fact, you know. And I would have to say that at the bottom, or and really at the beginning of knowledge in the U.S., in the Americas, really, North, Central, and South America, that indigenous knowledge, you know, precedes, you know, any other kind of knowledge. It is fundamental to the existence and the way in which I think we as a nation, and I say we in a very collective, you know, inclusive way, you know, not just Native or Indigenous people, but we as everybody in the United States, present in the Americas, that Indigenous knowledge is fundamental, you know. It's first, fundamental and primary to the way, you know, any kind of resolution and reconciliation is to be made.
That's a very interesting idea. And I know it's probably hard to, you know, in a quick radio interview, sum up or characterize the nature of that knowledge. But I was the other day, I was sitting in the Santa Fe Baking Company and looking around at the building, and you can see the structure of the building and the sort of rectilinear grid. And I was thinking how much that was like a Cartesian grid, which really forms the basis of a lot of our reality, you know, that. And I was thinking, what if you spoke another language that didn't have the word rectilinear and didn't have the concept of the Cartesian grid? This building couldn't and wouldn't exist.
Yes.
And so there's, and I thought, okay, what if I tried to just put my brain space in another, even though I don't speak your language, I don't speak Karis, you know, but just put my brain space in a more land-based linguistic framework for a little while. And then you start, and that connects for me with what you just said about the indigenous knowledge being primary. What can you say about that? What is that knowledge? What does that give us in a way that you can explain to us in words?
Well, we can look at, say, ourselves at present, just Santa Fe, the city itself, you know. Santa Fe prides itself with its particular kind of architectural, you know, the Santa Fe style, you know, which is patterned really on the indigenous Pueblo structure of their homes, of their buildings, their indigenous original traditional forms and architectural styles, you know. You will immediately see the similarities. You will immediately see, you know, the forms of the kiva, which are around in some of the pueblos, not all the pueblos. And you will find the building materials, you know, the adobes, you know, and the stonework and the shape of the plaza that's there in Santa Fe, you know, and in Albuquerque in certain areas, you know. And you will find that these are patterned after those pueblos at Tezuque, at Powaki, at San Juan, at Taos, at Acoma, and Santo Domingo, other of the original or aboriginal indigenous pueblos, you know, that people in Santa Fe then regard as the Santa Fe style. Well, there's more involved, obviously, you know, because one of the things that I think I find lacking in the Santa Fe style is the acknowledgement, you know, that this was originally not Moorish, or did not come from Spain, or did not come from New York City, or did not come from London, or other places, but this came from the local pueblos. And I think that's a step, you know, once you are able to say this indeed is indigenous and this indeed, you know, is a contribution made by the local landscape. And it relates very much to the language, you know, to what we say, you know, like we say in the Karis language, we say Ha'atzi, Sha'atzi, our land, you know, Sha'atzi. And that's not a difficult linguistic pronunciation to make, you know. We can make these associations and we can also conceptualize ourselves, you know, as a result, accordingly. I think that it's important what you bring up, you know, not only the Cartesian model, but the Pueblo, Nuyu, Taishi, Eme'e, Tseishi, you know. You know, what is here originally, the way it is, you know, and to follow according to the way it is. And it's much like what I was saying, you know, about recognizing the sovereignty. if you recognize the sovereignty, then you also live according to what is required by that sovereignty, not to your loss, but to really your gain.
We're talking to Simon Ortiz, and we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to give you a moment to talk about your new book and your participation in the literary part of the Indian market, which is, I guess, a brand new part of the market.
Well, I was very excited and felt very good to hear that indigenous literature was going to be included, acknowledged and included among the arts that are recognized and celebrated, because the arts are really essential to how human culture in general helps us to realize and grow as human beings. You know, I always think that, you know, that we share common sorts of things. And one of the things we share is the land, culture, and community in New Mexico. You know, we may have different cultural perspectives about it, but we share the responsibility for land, culture, and community. And I think that poetry, I'm going to read some poetry that reflects that kind of community and that kind of culture and that kind of, I think, responsibility that I have as a writer. And I'm just one writer, of course, you know, and my writing comes from a community of people.
Well, we look forward to seeing you, Simon Ortiz, writer, poet, and just to reiterate, the new book that's coming out about you is called Simon J. Ortiz, A Poetic Legacy of Indigenous Culture, edited by Evelina Zuni Lucero, who's going to be moderating the evening tonight, and Susan Barry Brill de Ramirez. And also, Clear Light Publishers will have a book tent during Indian Market, and they will feature 21 authors signing books from their Indian Market catalog. That's all day long on Saturday and Sunday, including you and Evelina Lucero, who will be there on Saturday at 2 in the afternoon.
Yes.
So, lots of things to do, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, I'm very happy that I had this opportunity to talk with you. And yes, come to the event tonight.
Absolutely.
And also on the book signings on Saturday.
Excellent. Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I'm very happy now to welcome Tom Johnson. He is a journalist, lecturer, and he is teaching a workshop this coming weekend, Saturday the 22nd of August, from 9 to 5, called Be Your Own Publisher at St. John's United Methodist Church here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you are somebody who has been in the world of publishing for a very long time, journalism and books. As everybody talks about, it's kind of a cliche that new media are changing everything, but there are many of us who still go out, buy a book, come home, and read it. How has publishing actually, and that's what we see on the surface, but behind the scenes, things are very different. How has publishing changed?
Well, I think the big changes, which are the result of the digital revolution, is that we see a power shift away from typical institutions, the big old line publishers, Harper and Row, Scribner's, etc., and the power shifting to the individual who has some ink on paper content that they want to have in a permanent form. And this can range from everything from novels to nonfiction to any company that has training materials that they need to periodically update. And today, anyone with a computer, a desktop computer, has the tools in that computer, they're already there, to prepare their own manuscript, to upload it to some particular print-on-demand sites, and have copies of ink on paper, but professionally bound, professionally looking, professionally designed publications that they can sell, they can distribute to their family, etc. What has happened in the publishing business, again, part of this shift, is that increasingly publishers do less and less in actually preparing the book. They pay smaller royalties. They don't invest the money in editing and copy editing and design.
So you have typos in, for example, right, which I always find in professionally published books.
That's right, because they simply haven't had been able to spend the money to have many eyes look at that manuscript. So this then shifts the power back to the individual author to take control of their own creative work and have full responsibility for the final publishing product. As I say, they can do this with applications they already have on their desktop, Microsoft Word and any PDF or a portable domain format file is all that they need to have.
So what kind of authors, what kind of books do you see being published in this way? I mean, is this equivalent to, for example, the people who publish their own music instead of trying to work with major record labels?
Yes, exactly. It can be that. And what we see are everything from teachers, for example, who are working with fifth and sixth grade kids to do have the kids doing oral histories with their grandparents and or of the community or of the neighborhood, and they want to have those published, and you're only going to need maybe 30, 40 copies, to at the other end, people who are engaging in a serious way in being authors of fiction or nonfiction, and they realize that the responsibility for selling and promotion of the product is going to fall to them anyway, and so they're taking control of the entire process.
For the consumer, how do you know, first of all, how do you find these books?
You can find them online. For example, the company that I talk about in this workshop, and I don't work for the company, I'm not affiliated in any way, is called Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. They have an arrangement with both Amazon and with Ingram, which is the largest wholesale distributor, so that if you publish your book and if you get what's called an ISBN number, it's a cataloging number that's used worldwide, you put the ISBN number on your book, it flows into Amazon and Ingram's databases. And so if you go to Amazon and do the normal lookup for an author or for a particular topic, your book will come up. You also then can have your own website is created for you at Lulu.com. So if in the promotional work, you can hand out business cards and say, here, go to this site and buy my book.
We're talking to Tom Johnson. His workshop this coming weekend is called Be Your Own Publisher. So do you see fiction? Do you see authors who either just haven't been able to find the agent or their way into New York publishing houses but want to publish their book of short stories or their novel?
Absolutely. You see, as I said, everything that where you typically see ink on paper will be published in this form. And another advantage to the individual author is that you retain all rights to that printed copy. You've got the copyright on it. It's yours. You can go ahead and publish in this format, do the promotion, do the selling, do the readings in bookstores, etc. And at the same time, while you're out trying to find an agent or trying to find a larger publisher who will pick up your book and then promote it in a big way. And when you do, if you're lucky enough to find a publisher to do that, but now you're in a power position for negotiating because you have camera-ready pages all ready to go for that publisher. And they don't have to spend the investment in having typeset, which can cost $100 a page in
some
cases.
Do they still typeset?
Well, they're finally getting away from it. But I have a good friend here in Santa Fe who is a very well-known writer who works for a large, well-known publishing company. And 10 years ago, he, after carefully editing his manuscript, sent them his manuscript on a disc, and he got the galleys back, and in the first six pages he had the same name spelled two different ways, etc. He said, what did you do? He said, well, we sent it out to be typeset. I think the industry is not quite that antiquated any longer, but sometimes it can happen. Nevertheless, if you can give a publisher camera-ready pages, you're negotiating from position of strength.
It is very interesting that because of the relative affordability of digital media. Everybody could afford a computer, which, 30 years ago, nobody even had one. And the ease of use of all of this software, and everybody understands it and all that. You can take this stuff into your own hands. It also means that you have to be a self-promoter, you have to be a copy editor, you have to be a good writer, you have to be
a graphic designer.
Yeah.
Yes. And there are many different steps in this process. And while one might not pay a financial price, one does have to pay a learning curve price. And so you might be a very good writer, but you might not have an eye for graphic design and layout and picking typography. This is where we try to work with our clients to say, okay, this is an area where some consulting, a little bit of dollar investment in consulting will go a long way. Cover design can be very important. And if you don't have that particular skill set, then maybe it's to the author's advantage to spend $500 in hiring a good designer to do the cover.
Do these books that are published in this way ever end up in bookstores?
Yes, and here again it depends on the individual author who is going out and making the contacts. And this is especially true if you have books that have would have a strong local interest. And here in northern New Mexico, things of local history are often of interest to the people in the retail bookstores. Now, it might be hard to crack Barnes & Noble, but it might you would have a good chance, I think, of talking to the folks at Downtown Subscriptions and Garcia Books, etc.
Collected Works,
and being there, assuming that you again take that step and do the marketing, and perhaps you have point-of-purchase displays, perhaps you create some bookmarks that you can use to hand out as promotional material, you're doing the readings, all of that kind of thing.
You also get to set your own price.
That's right. The Lulu.com, as I talked about, has a the reason why I like that particular company is I've been covering the digital revolution for 30 years. I lived in the Bay Area and started in the late 70s covering it. And when I look at, I looked at about 40 or 50 different print-on-demand operations before selecting Lulu, partially because their programming is so elegant. That if you follow the steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, you essentially can create the book. And one of those steps is they will ask you, what trim size do you want on the book? Do you want it to be hardcover or paperback? And how many pages will it have? And the number of pages, of course, is a big factor in determining the price. That's where your manufacturing cost is.
And then you have to always figure out whether you're going to have it be little tiny print that people have to use glasses
That's
or squint
right.
at.
That's right. So you're going to do that ahead of time. But when you do it, Lulu has this terrific online calculator, and you just put in the data, and they say, okay, the cost of producing one of these books, four color cover, but black and white, everything black and white inside, will be, pick a number, $8. They say, all right, that's the cost of manufacturing one, or it's a per unit cost, whether it's one or 100. Then they say, if you want to sell this at retail, you set the retail price. So let's say $15 is going to be the retail price. Lulu then makes its money by taking 25% of that spread between 8 and 15. So you've got 25%, 75% of that $7 spread is going to come back to you as a royalty, which is considerably higher than what any publisher is really paying these days.
In theory, what the publisher can give you is tons of promotion. They don't always do that, though.
They rarely do it, increasingly rarely. And most authors, I think, and you've certainly talked to many on this show, will tell you that the ultimate responsibility for marketing promotion and promotion falls back on them.
Yeah.
They've got to contact the Mary Charlottes of America and say, look, can I come in and talk to you about my book?
Or they hire at their own expense a publicist.
That's right.
To do that.
That's right.
So have you seen people who do this and actually make significant amounts of money doing it?
It's significant. There is one guy that I know who looked at the book industry, and he'd written a novel called The Take Us, and he said, well, how do I become a Stephen King? How do I become a Tom Clancy? And he realized that it wasn't the literary works that those guys had created in the long run. It was their celebrity. And so he took it upon himself to market himself in the long run. And he's hired a publicist, as you said. He's literally put cases of books in the back of his car and hit the road. This is his first novel. His second one will be out soon. He's about, I think, close to breaking even on his first novel. But he's got this long-range marketing strategy where he's selling himself And then, oh yeah, here's my latest book, becomes
right.
secondary. So there's that end. Most of the people who are interested in this Be Your Own Publisher run us a range, a continuum from, as I say, grade school teachers who are doing local histories to people of grandparent age who are starting to write their memoirs, and they know that they're only going to have 20, 30 copies is all they're going to need for their family, but they want them to look nice. The advantage to working with Lulu is that you don't make any financial investment up front. Many of these publish-on-demand companies say, yeah, here's our $500 package, here's our $900 package, etc. Give us some money and we'll do your book. With Lulu, that doesn't happen. That said, they act as the go-between. If you need a particular vendor, as I say, a cover designer, if you need copy editors and so forth, they can help you find those people to do that particular segment of your book. But the result is that when it comes time for a press run, you can print one copy, or you can print 50, or you can print 100. You can go back and correct errors like the typos you spoke of earlier if you want to. And you never have to carry an inventory for this stuff.
And so you can order 5 today, and then in 3 weeks you can order another 20.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Now, how does that compare to the so-called vanity presses?
Well, they usually, as I say, number one, want some money up front.
So, in a way, it really is a vanity press. It's just another way of doing it.
Yes, I would say so. It's one without a huge financial investment.
Right.
And so the vanity presses then will do a press run, a print run of X number of copies, usually 500 at a minimum. And so now you've got these cases of books in the garage.
Right. We're talking to Tom Johnson. His workshop this coming weekend, this Saturday from 9 to 5, is called Be Your Own Publisher. So you are a longtime journalist and professor of journalism. Tell us a little bit about your own career.
Well, I started in the business in the early 70s when I was in graduate school at the University of Kansas. And I was working at that time for Time Magazine, covering Kansas and western Missouri, and also for United Press, and was a stringer for the Wichita paper and the Topeka Capital, worked at the Topeka Capital Journal, and also a stringer for the New York Times. And then after graduate school, I got a job in San Francisco as an editor with Scientific American, and I worked for both the magazine and their book division.
So when you're an editor for Scientific American, what does your background need to be in science?
Well, it wasn't particularly strong. My undergraduate degree is in journalism, but just barely. But my graduate work is in urban history, and in particular the impact of technology on urban places. And so as a result of that, I learned how to do the research as opposed to the content. And ask the right questions, we hope. And so in San Francisco, this is just one of the world centers of scientific work. And so when I moved to San Francisco, to say I worked for Scientific American for about a year and a half, and then I took a teaching post at San Francisco State in the journalism department, and that allowed me to do a lot of freelancing. And so I continued to work for Time Magazine covering science there. I was the West Coast editor for Popular Science for a period of time. I was the startup editor for a weekly news magazine called Mac Week. And so being in San Francisco, you're right in the belly of the digital revolution. It was a very exciting time.
How have you seen people's reading habits change since you've been in journalism?
Well, as you know, the condition of journalism today is somewhat precarious. Maybe it's very precarious.
It's certainly looking that way.
Especially, yeah, because there's a couple of factors. One of them is that I argue that journalism is journalists are driven largely by adrenaline and not intellect. They really like getting after that hot story, and the industry as a whole has not invested in education for its employees. Consequently, people are trying to do journalism in a new environment, and they're trying to do the journalism of 30 and 40 years ago in the same way. For example, I read somewhere that there was something like 5,000 pages of testimony just came out on Karl Rove and the whole White House thing. Well, how do you deal with 5,000 physical pages?
5,000 pages.
5,000 pages. How do you get at that content? Well, there's a way that you can do it by scanning the pages automatically, by putting that into optical character recognition, by putting that into open source databases, open text databases, so that you can quickly go through and search for words or combinations of words to tease meaning out of it. Well, only a very, very small number of journalists even have a clue that you can do that.
Right.
They tend to collect anecdotes and quotes and string them together in a readable story and let it go at that. So that's one of the big changes. The question was about readership. I think that we see that people do not, for a variety of reasons, have the time or the interest to doing long-form, serious study. It's a quick hit-and-go kind of thing.
Except and that's for those what they're holdouts given. Who read The New Yorker.
The New Yorker and Vanity Fair has good stuff from time to time. The
right.
Atlantic and Harper's still hang in there.
Right.
So there are some monuments of hope abroad in the land.
At the same time, people are, I guess, influenced by soundbite style
yes.
TV, and that affects
right.
their reading habits as well.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, the whole issue of investigative journalism is a big problem as well. There's not only not so many people who are trained to do that, but above all, there aren't very many people paying people to do that.
That's right. And investigative journalism is the most expensive type because it simply cannot be done quickly. It's the kind of thing like mining for gold where you have to process a ton of ore to get 3 ounces of gold. That plus the fact here again that in the digital era, quantitative data is readily available if one can take the time and go get it. And most journalists, most people have come into journalism as a first refuge for the mathematically phobic. And today, to do a good story, I argue that you have to be able to traverse the slope from quantitative to qualitative and go back and forth. And so you do need some analytic skills. Even simple statistics
right.
is a big help. And most journalists aren't interested or don't have the time to learn how to do that or to recall their sixth grade mathematics.
You know, it would be interesting if every college freshman curriculum included some little course called, you know, enough statistics so that they can't fool you.
Yes, exactly right.
Then there's also the question of local news
yes.
and local newspapers folding.
Yep.
And, I mean, the big problem with that is if there's no local news, people in their own town have no idea what's going on around them. They might know what's
yep.
happening in Washington, D.C., but not in their city council.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it takes money, and people have been, because of the Internet, have become accustomed to getting a whole lot of stuff for free. And so the big battle in the newspaper business today is how do we, the word is monetize, how do we make any money from this online news thing? And there are different attempts being tried. Nobody has the real answer yet, and it's going to take probably another decade before this all gets sorted out.
We're talking to Tom Johnson, journalist and lecturer. Oh, God, there was one more thing that made me think of, too. Let me think for a second. Oh, yeah. It's also very hard if you have something to say or something to give to make money off of that, too. For example, it's not clear why anybody would even buy a cookbook anymore.
That's right.
Because there's so many recipes online. That's just one example among thousands.
Yes, exactly so. In fact, just last night I needed a recipe for how do you stew rhubarb, and I went online to find just that answer.
So this weekend, Saturday from 9 to 5, you're going to be doing the Be Your Own Publisher workshop. When you've done things like that in the past, what kind of authors and writers have shown up?
We literally will get everyone from, as I said, school teachers who want to do this. We'll get people who have small businesses where they have, maybe they're a distributor of a particular product and they have customers around the state, and they need to update their material about their products every 6 months or so, and they want to have it both in ink on paper form and also online. And one of the things about this workshop is that we teach people how to create their own work in both e-book format, you can put it up online, or in ink on paper format. And so it's essentially the same process. We get people who are, as I said, grandparents who want to do family histories. I've got a couple books here of photographers, and because you can do photo books with text. We get people who represent an organization and they do want to do a recipe book. That can go out. So anything that can be done ink on paper can be produced today on your computer and then made available in hard copy version or online.
Do you use a Kindle or any of those book reader, electronic book readers?
Yes, I do not. I'm waiting for the next generation of Kindle, which will have color and will allow me a little more flexibility so that I can use it as a browser without paying some outrageous fees. My wife has been talking about a Kindle, but we haven't gone there yet.
It is funny that there was recently this very Orwellian thing that happened, which was that Amazon had sold people a book by George Orwell, and in the ultimate irony, they deleted...
They sucked it right off of your Kindle.
They deleted it off of their
Kindle. Yes, yes, yes. Which I think...
And gave them a refund, but still.
That's right. I think that will... has probably caused some great discussions among Amazon headquarters about where do we go with this.
Tom Johnson is with Indie Publishing West. His event is called Be Your Own Publisher, Saturday, August 22nd from 9:15 to 5 in the afternoon at the St. John's United Methodist Church at Old Pecos Trail at Cordova Road, the Pumpkin Church. Information and registration, people can call 505-473-9646.
Or they can go to our website to register, which is Indie, I-N-D-I-E. PubWest.com.
IndiePubWest.com.
Right.
Tom Johnson, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at KSFR.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@KSFR.org. We're podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe.